Chapter 3 West Interviews. John sat facing a computer monitor, examining each drawing in the set. When he was satisfied to his level of scrutiny, the last thing he did before moving on to the next page was to put his signature on the document. This indicated his company was ready to spend the resources necessary to bring that page of the ship to reality. At 73 feet long and 47 feet wide, the ship was going to be comprised mostly of fuel. The fuel would surround the central core of the ship that housed the two-step drive units. The fuel cell power supply encircled the area around the step drives, and the plasma thrust engine took up most of the rear section. The space set aside for the four occupants was an area circling the front portion of the craft. At 14 feet in length, and with a diameter of 8 feet, the living space also included the drive's axial tube. This tube, which runs the length of the ship, is used to support the generation of the intense plasmoid structure. Storage is outside in containers meant to fit cutouts specifically designed to hold them. Finally, the compression coils mounted on the 8 outriggers encircling the length of the small ship. With the design complete, and without spotting the single objectionable detail, John signed off on the last of the drawings and shut down the computer. It took 7 months before Stepchild, the first Mars-rated transport, was finally being run through its paces over the same baseline that Sarah had used for Skiff-10 tests. With the Step-2 drive operational, it was going to take 4.7 days to get to Mars, and years to get past Rachel's naming convention. To make the journey meant running the fuel cell reactor at 90% capacity, the plasma thrust motor at 15% of the full burn rate on the second step, with the step drive at near maximum mode for the same period. Everything ran off the electricity produced by the fuel cells, and both cells and thrust engine used hydrogen. To get the specific impulse right, the thrust motor consumed a second heavy isotope that was vaporized and ionized by the motor's plasma. But hydrogen was the main fuel source, and it was going to require a lot. The plan was to eventually land on Mars and set up shop, but the first 4 months was planning and movement of materials. A total of 5 flights were made to Mars without landing on it, and each time excess fuel and materials were deposited at Deimos, the little staging area. This may all sound straightforward, but it's not. Any momentum built up in step space is conserved in step space. This means that if Earth is your starting point, your velocity vector when you take a step is tangential to Earth's orbit around the Sun. This is because the ship is moving with the Earth, and therefore Earth's vector and velocity. Well, Mars has something to say about that. It is moving in a completely different direction at a completely different velocity. You need to plan ahead. Coming out of step space, your velocity vector needs to match your target. Otherwise, a lot of time and energy is wasted trying to adjust. When John explained the procedure to Sarah and the gang, it was the only time in her life that she accused him of being fucking crazy. The first Mars run consisted of Sarah, John, Anne, and Vlad. Though the vector alteration maneuver had been tested with the new ship, this was the first time it would use Earth to get the needed velocities. It also meant having to deal with Earth's magnetic field, something John's drive didn't cope with well. With this fact in mind, the flight left the moon and took a short step away from Earth. It then pointed the nose in the direction where Earth was going to be in 4 hours' time, and the craft accelerated into the oncoming gravity well. 300 miles above the surface, traveling nearly 18,000 meters per second slower than the planet was advancing, the drive went on step and held it for several seconds at 10% thrust. This placed the craft far enough away from Earth's magnetic field to get a new, accurate alignment for the trip to Mars. Once configured, the crew said their farewells to Weiss Harbor, and they were gone. Twice a day, Skiff 9 waited on step for a call from the Stepchild. Once the status report was given, the small craft would resume its advance on the red planet at Step 2. The radio's inability to function between levels puzzled everyone, and minus the electronics delay, the radio lag time was still zero between the two distant ships. Miguel had a theory to speak to that as well, which was fine. Everybody agreed. Then there is still no valid explanation for the acceleration force behaving the same for the craft on or off step. The 15% thrust meant the crew had the luxury of experiencing one quarter of Earth's gravity while on step. The sixth run was going to include a Mars landing. The only equipment that was brought along was personnel Skiff 11, which would make the trip from orbit to the surface with Sarah, Rachel, and John as the passengers. John planned on staying for part of the day, getting some samples, saying a few words, and rejoining the stepchild at Deimos. They would leave the skiff at the staging area, while the stepchild and her crew headed for home. Sarah's birthday was soon to take place, and while wrapping up packages, John had an idea and asked the girls if they might like to leave some presents behind on Mars. Should be fun, he told them. Dottie pointed to the title on the screen. Let's watch Sarah's birthday, remembering her own party when she had turned 8. No, Chandra said forcefully. Let's go there, and the mouse pointer found its mark before the complaints started. JPL Archives. Presidio gleamed in the morning sun as it awoke from the evening slumber to begin another day of exploration on the Red Planet. The six-wheeled drill rig had just finished performing the start-of-day self-tests. As the rover compiled a status report to send back to the science team at JPL, it became aware of a change to its surroundings. The only rover of its kind, it was capable of drilling a 2-inch hole 12 feet into the Martian rocky soil. The cuttings were viewed and analyzed by a myriad of instruments. When the proper depth was achieved, the drill was extracted and several sensor packages got deployed. These instruments tested for electrical resistance and radioactive decay at different depths. Finally, a 3-axis silicone accelerometer got deposited at the bottom. The accelerometer, attached to a low-power amplifier, is capable of recording any seismic event for a duration of 1 month. Once tested, the battery-powered device is then covered with loose material before the rover moves on, leaving behind a thin wire protruding from the surface. Using the sensor's tiny radio, a volatile log file gets transmitted to the aerial drone, which passes over once a day. The usual seismic activity came from the noise of the rover off drilling new holes somewhere. The information garnered from these vibrations included the velocity of sound through the local geology, something studied intently by the resident geologists who shared the control room with the other two rover scientists back on Earth. The AI internal to the rover's software confirmed that the terrain had changed and the object in its path was of a shape inconsistent with the database of information it used for recognition. The object was also emitting radiation in the visible spectrum, which triggered additional protocols. The rover's stereoscopic camera and laser rangefinder indicated that the object was 10.4 meters forward of its position along the pre-programmed path. Its decision-making software began taking a series of pictures while slowly advancing on the unknown object. All the while, the information was being relayed through several of the satellites visible to the radio antenna on top of the rather awkward-looking vehicle. The rover had yet to get as close as either research arm required for a thorough analysis, because the artificial intelligence software decided to wait for instructions to proceed. At about this time, the first pictures were being processed and displayed to the team at JPL, which caused a rushed phone call to the manager. Hanging up the phone, Jim was left with an impression that the guys were screwing around. As he walked into the tiny 3-man control room, he found everyone staring at the screen on the wall. It appears to be a small rocket that crashed on the surface and broke apart, Jim thought to himself. Sam? Jim Tyson, the project manager, inquired. Do we have anything on the books about some kind of probe that was scheduled for some kind of arrival or something today? No, sir, was the slow response from his friend of 8 years, who had not called him sir in 7 of them. The next data download indicated flashes of light coming from where the 2 sections of the craft must have made it, now broken apart and exposed. What's the rover telling us about the nature of the light? Asked Jim. Followed up with, status shows that the rover is rolling low-res video on that section now. Should be down in 19 minutes or so. The flashing has a pattern, but Presidio can't analyze it. The spectrograph data covers 3 seconds, and it shows the source to be brief flashes of around 100 milliseconds. Probably some shorted wiring causing arcing is my guess. As the next still pictures came in, the group stopped breathing, followed by an audible gasp. Jim reached for the phone. Gone were the days when the director of JPL, lost and confused, would aimlessly walk the maze of corridors that made up the Pentagon. These days she knew exactly where the conference room was, where a group of military bureaucrats was going to try and steal her blind. It was through the door to the right of Becky Tanner's desk. Becky, a young woman of 30, was always cordial as she checked the IDs and logged in the visitors. She had alerted Tiffany to the number of geeks roaming the halls looking to pwn an unsuspecting person of the data on their electronic devices, using the latest sophisticated toys. Anymore, Tiffany used a burner phone and called forwarding whenever she walked in this building. The room never changed, with its drab, white, hardboard wall and hideous patchwork carpet, on which stood a budget-friendly table surrounded by 8 chairs. A conference phone adorns the table and a projector hung from the ceiling. Other than that, the room was bare and impersonal. Tiffany's sleeve had been the director at JPL for just over 2 years now. She was starting to get the hang of this high-level politicking required to keep needed projects funded, and today was no different. Seated next to her was her counterpart at NASA, Luke Brennan, a lanky, good-natured intellect. He had the strenuous task of having to oversee the entire space program, only his graying hair giving an indication that the stresses of the job were taking their toll. Seated in the conference room opposite them were 3 officials from the Department of Defense, DOD. Their job was to explain that the U.S. Space Force had fiscal priority. The expenditure for the Advanced Supercomputer Project was earmarked to be funded through NASA's budget for the next 4 quarters, that the expense was a necessary one for the security of the country, and therefore, a few of your science projects will have to be put on hold. The back and forth was not going well for either director when their phone brought the discussion to a much-appreciated halt. Tiffany and Luke had each received urgent texts at the same moment, requesting a secure call immediately. As a meeting was being held in the Pentagon, the conference phone on the table routed to a secure switchboard, and a call was made to the JPL rover manager. A quick conversation with Becky Tanner caused a flurry of activity from an unseen technician somewhere in the building. The tech got the projector displaying the latest data from Mars rover on the sidewall of the room along with Jim's face, inlaid on the lower left corner. Jim began his talk but was cut short when a door opened and everyone in the conference room stood. The Secretary of Defense, SOD, Marcy Cooper, entered and looked around the room.
Everyone, please sit down, Marcy motioned with her hand.
Todd, you texted me, requested I sit in on this call. What's up?
Assistant Secretary of Defense for Acquisition, Todd Radcliffe, had been assigned to the Pentagon for several administrations, and he liked the big purse strings he oversaw. He also knew when to back away and let someone else have the reins. This appeared to be one of those moments. Todd pointed to the screen and said,
JPL has a rover situation, and I thought you might want to sit in. We were just about to be briefed.
Okay, was the response from the SOD. Tiffany, nice to see you both, accompanied a quick nod towards Luke. Would you care to make the introductions?
Yes, ma'am,
Tiffany stated, then continued, Jim Tyson is the manager of the Presidio Rover team investigating the area around Olympus Mons. Marcy nodded to the man on the screen and said, Proceed, Mr. Tyson. Jim cleared his throat and jumped in. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Well, approximately 1 hour ago, we began to get unscheduled camera images from the rover when it discovered a new object in its intended path. Tiffany broke in with, The rover would have gone into sleep mode yesterday with an updated 3D terrain map and laser ranging information. Whatever that thing is, it was not there when the rover powered down for the night. Please continue, Jim.
Jim's next statement heightened the listener's interest. From our analysis of the images, the object appears to be a space vehicle that suffered a catastrophic landing and broke apart.
Are those bodies? Cried Second Lieutenant Smith.
An Air Force liaison to the Space Force Computer Crimes Division. This newest picture showed three bodies, which were spread-eagle on the rocky surface. They all appeared to be wearing white-covered spacesuits of some kind, but it was as though the suits had all become overpressurized. Only one of the bodies was face up. The high-res pictures appeared to show that the helmet was intact, with a face apparently pressed up against the glass. The bodies unmoving. The pictures unsettling. Next to the outstretched arm lay a flag of some kind attached to a sharpened pole. Jim did not answer the question. He did not have to. The pictures spoke for themselves. He finally broke the silence.
We have some video that has become available that I'll put on the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. Stand by.
Moments later, the low-res video began showing the bursts of light, which highlighted a bent and broken craft. As the video played, they all stared for what seemed like minutes, watching the screen update with additional photos of the crash site and the bodies on the ground. Jim's next statement was even more perplexing.
What we don't understand is the scale of what we are seeing. The ship itself is estimated to be about a meter long. The bodies, or whatever they are, appear to be only about an inch in length from the top of the head portion to the bottom protrusions.
He continued,
If what we are seeing is real, they did not originate on...
Turn around, came the voice of Luke Brennan. All eyes turned his way.
I'm sorry, sir. What was that?
Jim's anxious response sounded strained. Luke slowly voiced what he was seeing.
It says, turn around. The flashes of light. It's Morse code and it reads, turn around.
Mars Archives. Pouring the champagne into the glasses, John West couldn't help but think, what a classic. Even the girls thought it was hilarious. None of them could stop laughing before, during, or after it was over. Some were not as amused. JPL, NASA, and the White House, the Joint Chiefs, and the rest of the people experiencing were first alarmed, then excited, and finally mad as hell. The trio had left the relative comfort of the small enclosure several times to walk around on the surface of Mars and collect samples. It seemed like it never took long, and the cycle would repeat. First there would be a giggle. Then another voice-activated radio would key up with another chuckle, only louder. And then all three of the Mars explorers would be laughing themselves sick. The stay was short, but they would be back in no time, looking for a cavern to tunnel into. It was a system well established by now, and the teams were getting good at it. As the skiff lifted off the surface of Mars, the rover was making its way back to the flexible dome that stood near the southern base of the gigantic Olympus Mons. The audience, who had been included on the conference with JPL, were still there, as the rover's close-up pictures of the dome came through. The group had seen the skiff sitting there, had seen the three passengers disappear inside the vehicle, and they watched it leave the surface. Now all they were left with was a clear dome structure housing the three folding chairs grouped around a small table. On the table was an empty bottle of champagne in an ice bucket, three empty wine glasses, and a half-full dish of gummy space monkeys.
Two words were embossed on the side of the dome near the top: Western Wave.